Hello and welcome to this special edition of the IC Companies and Markets podcast. My name's Ian Smith. I'm the company's editor of the IC. Joining me in the podcast today on this very exciting morning is Emma Powell, our news editor. How are you doing, Emma?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Bit tired. And also my deputy companies editor, Mark Robinson. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm fine, Ian. Fresh as a daisy.
Well, I'm not, because last night was the general election results coming in all through the night. Much more exciting than people had thought. And I think what we found out is that no election was better than a bad election for Theresa May. But Emma, why don't you start us off? Tell us where we are at in terms of the seats, in terms of how the parties have done. And then we can talk a little bit about the implications.
Yeah, so for once, the exit poll actually seemed to be pretty accurate, which was a shock, I think, about this time, about 11 o'clock last night. So at the minute, we've got Conservatives on 319 seats, Labour on 261, the Scottish National Party on 35, Lib Dem on 12, and the Democratic Unionist Party on 10.
And we should say we're recording this podcast at 10 in the morning on Friday, but that's just with one seat left to go, so it's not going to change hardly at all.
So it will be a hung parliament, of course, because you need 326 or 323, given that Sinn Féin don't take up their seats in the House of Commons usually. So that's 10 seats lost for the Conservatives and also 19 for the SNP. But the big winner would be the Labour Party, who've gained, well, at least 31 seats, maybe 32 if they get that final seat. Lib Dems actually also did better than expected. They won three seats, although, of course, former leader Nick Clegg did lose his seat.
So where do we stand? Conservatives haven't got enough for a majority, but with the support of the DUP, the unionists in Northern Ireland, they can form a minority government.
They can, yeah. I mean, it's a tricky situation because, of course, the whole point of this election was to kind of strengthen her hand, strengthen Theresa May's hand, and obviously, I think this is this has just done nothing but weaken it. So it's looking, I don't know, the prospect is that they will form a minority government with the DUP propping them up. That's difficult in itself, given the kind of caveats that Democratic Unionists have already given.
The big question this morning is whether Theresa May will stay on as Prime Minister. Now, we may well get overtaken by events in that case, but how does that look as we talk now?
Well, she said that she has no intention of resigning, and obviously that is still a live situation, so you never know. She said she intends to stay as Prime Minister or as leader of the party. It's quite interesting. It was an interesting tweet which keeps getting kind of flagged this morning that she did, admittedly, on the 19th of May, which was very early, and obviously they had a big lead in the polls then, which she said, if I lose just six seats, I will lose this election and Jeremy Corbyn will be sitting down to negotiate with Europe. Obviously, probably regrets making that statement now, although she did make that quite early on.
At a time where they had much more of a poll lead.
Exactly.
But Mark,
yeah,
that Brexit negotiations is where everyone's mind is turning toward, and that's expected to kick off on the 19th of June. What do you think people are thinking right now in terms of the impact on the UK's bargaining strength in that negotiation?
Well, it rather depends on what your political perspective was prior to the election. It obviously weakens the UK hand. I mean, they need the government to go in there with a unified stance. The negotiations were always likely to be difficult enough as they were, but with there's every chance that Westminster will sort of now enter a period of paralysis, and it's going to make it all the more difficult in the run-up to the negotiations itself.
Because we can't rule out, and we shouldn't rule out, having another election. If the right deal can't be done, it maybe looks unlikely at this point. We could be seeing a rerun of the election.
Well, I was just trying to remember the last time that we ran effectively with a minority government in the United Kingdom. I think you'd have to go back to the 1970s, I think. And it presents any number of problems just in the day-to-day running of Westminster and Whitehall, for that matter. We're going to obviously see a lot of political posturing in the days and weeks to come as well, because obviously this plays into the hands of people that want us to remain in the European Union, or those calling for a second referendum. But it's obviously very early days at this point.
One interesting line that's come out relevant to what you're saying is the Democratic Unionists have been saying that they will support a Conservative government if Northern Ireland is not guaranteed any kind of unique special status in the Brexit deal that would keep the region kind of inside the EU to kind of ease the situation in Ireland. Now, that's a line that's coming out of The Guardian. So one implication that the election could have on the Brexit negotiations is that although it's a weakened government, the deal that would have to be done between the Tories and the DUP would, you know, in some ways harden Brexit. That's one side of the argument.
But the contra-argument runs as well that because of the standing as far as the seats go, there are enough Conservative MPs who are pro-Remain who would force the issue of a more meaningful secondary vote going before Parliament when the eventual terms of Brexit are crystallised.
And that's how a lot of commentators are seeing this election, Emma, that it's a rejection of Theresa May's approach for Brexit as set out in the Conservative manifesto, where she reiterated that no deal was better than a bad deal, that immigration would be the sine qua non for Conservative priorities, and that the UK's the UK's government had accepted leaving the single market and the customs union and renegotiating terms of a trade deal. So some people are saying that approach has been rejected.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't deny that Brexit overshadowed all the campaigns, didn't it, really? And people aligned kind of Theresa May very much with this kind of hard Brexit style, I think. So I think, yeah, definitely the kind of vote, the weakening of her position is definitely reflective of that kind of approach.
What do we think of the market reaction to the election? Because obviously there were people in the market that were saying both things. One, that the Eurosceptic wing of the Tory party could be empowered, especially if Theresa May had to step down, and that actually part of the reason for calling this election was to strengthen her hand, to allow her some strength in Parliament to be able to kind of stand down the more right-wing MPs within her own party. And in some ways this emboldens the right wing, and other people, as you've said, think that actually this kind of strengthens the House of Commons hand. Vince Cable, who was re-elected, said that it's going to be very hard to pass things like the Great Repeal Bill through Parliament in the way that the Conservatives have wanted to do so. So House of Commons, the makeup of that and the impact of that on Brexit is different. And we've seen both views expressed in the marketplace by investment bank strategists and fund managers. But what we have seen and what we saw from the very publication of the exit poll was a fall in the value of sterling again.
Yeah, there was a dip in the pound, unsurprisingly. But then I think it's not like you could compare these reactions to what we saw after the referendum result. It's nowhere near.
Well, that was much the same with the election result in America as well. And whether that just indicates that manager money, except that they overreacted following the EU referendum vote, and their reaction has been muted as a result.
Yeah, I mean, it did seem to move sharply down when people thought that Jeremy Corbyn might have a chance of moving through the door of number 10. And then when people started to question the exit poll, sterling started to come back. Now, obviously, you can put far too much stock in the market forces reflections or your idea of what the market's trying to say. But there definitely was kind of a weakening there. But obviously, that's not necessarily a bad thing for UK companies. And we've seen a similar pattern in terms of the equity market moves this morning that we saw after the referendum, albeit not to the same degree.
Yeah, exactly. It's not surprising that house builders, I think Crest Nicholson is the biggest faller, around 5%. Then a lot of the kind of more domestic facing banks like Lloyds and RBS and things like that, they've seen the biggest falls. But then, of course, the companies with more dollar denominated earnings have been the biggest risers. We've got quite a lot of kind of Ashmore Group, emerging markets focused asset manager,
and a lot of the commodity
and
stocks,
a lot of the miners and things like that, and the commodity stocks.
I mean, that's quite mechanistic, isn't it? That, you know, that the earning, the dollar earners are going to rise. I mean, the fallers are interesting to look at because they reflect some concerns around the economic health of the UK, particularly consumer demand. So the house builders, some of the retail stocks, and also companies that are exposed to the UK corporate sector. But as we saw after the referendum, that actually provided a great opportunity for some people to buy into these stocks, which have been very highly valued. And that some people did dramatically well because some of these house builders have done a lot of work since the financial crash to build up their capital levels, pay out high dividends. You could say the same of Lloyds, for example. And that's another stock that fell, I wouldn't say heavily this morning, but fell sharply and then kind of recovered a little bit. So there will be a lot of buyers in the market as well. They'll be taking advantage of politically driven moves.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, but the one caveat is, and I'm sure that we'd all agree on this, is that we've been looking at valuations for FTSE 350 companies over the last 10 months or so, and they're in no way justified by underlying earnings from a historical perspective. So we're all trying to work out if there's a new standard price earnings ratio that's being applied across the board now. There's some debate about that, but if anyone, any of our listeners out there has any idea if that's the case, then please get in contact with us.
Yeah, definitely how it reflects on the, yeah, that whole, that live valuation debate is really interesting. Now, we want to move on the discussion a little bit and say, well, we can't predict, especially not at this point, what will be the outcome of this hung parliament, whether Theresa May will be able to cobble together the seats that she needs and maintain her leadership, and really the firm impact on Brexit. But what we could look at is the areas where there are overlap between Labour and Tories. I would say, I'd postulate that some of the more extreme or less popular things within the Tory manifesto amongst their own party, such as things like grammar schools, might be less likely in the case where they don't have a majority and they're reliant on the DUP, for example. But there are other areas where there is kind of full consensus in the across the political spectrum that there needs to be work done. So both the Labour and Tory manifesto address this question of productivity. And Mark, in this week's issue, you wrote the cover feature, which is solving the Brexit puzzle and having a look at the Tories' industrial strategy and how it was supposed to be getting the UK economy moving.
Well, unfortunately, that Brexit puzzle has just become all the more complex, or more likely, we won't be getting into any meaningful negotiations for a delayed period now. But then again, that's just conjecture as well, as we don't know the eventual political settlement. So we'll have to wait on that in that regard.
But do you think we can accept that if the Tories want to bring forward their National Productivity Investment Fund, that they will find some support, you would hope or think, among Labour, who have their own proposal in their manifesto for a national transformation fund, and some of the areas of investment are exactly the same?
Well, exactly. I mean, there's no doubt that it would be an easier bill to pass through Parliament than some of the other pieces of legislation that are the point of contention at the moment. I mean, the difficulty I had when I came to write this piece, along with our man in Sicily, Dan Liberto, is that it's such a broad subject, and of course, our sainted editor, John Heumann, who's off on his sabbatical at the moment, is studying for his master's degree in industrial history. And so every week I was presented with a new scenario. And so in the end, I just settled upon the issues of productivity in the United Kingdom and also the issue of tariffs. They mightn't seem like they're interrelated, but they are. And what I wanted to express as well, amongst above anything else, is that depending on how the Brexit negotiations went in the weeks and months, we'd be able to present some sort of coherent narrative for our readers about which sectors are likely to be impacted, because we tend to think that the negotiations, when they do get into train, will be on a drip-drip basis, sector by sector, and with profound implications for some sectors, less so for others. Over the last year or so since the vote, we've assiduously avoided comment for Brexit for Brexit's sake, because it would just be pure speculation for the most part. I suspect after last night's result, we'll be kicking that can down the road a little further until a political settlement. But our readers will all be aware that it, whatever happens, it's going to have an effect on their portfolios.
What do you think, in broad terms, would be the impact of a very disruptive Brexit in terms of, say, high trade barriers being erected between the UK and the single market on what the Tories want to do in terms of the industrial strategy?
Well, it rather depends. I mean, if we were to crash out of the single market altogether, or at least under the terms that we operate in at the moment, some sectors would face major challenges, principally agriculture, because let's not forget the European Union is a political project rather than an economic one. And this is reflected in the tariff mechanisms that are in play at the moment. So obviously, the one of the highest barriers is agriculture, because it's a trade-off with the French rural sector and also, to a certain degree, Germany and Italy as well. Whereas other areas within the UK economy, such as financial services and our service sector, are relatively untouched by this mechanism at the moment. However, that's changing, because part of the EU's current political thrust is to bring in more regulation and more uniformity in these areas. And a lot of this is going to be through qualified majority voting as well. So it's going to obviously lessen the influence of the city in that regard. I think the average tariff rate, though, if we were going to go on WTO, as other nations operate in the European Union, is only about 6%. And I was talking to some of the people in Churchill, China, a while back, who very successful company, UK Potter, actually. It's a redolent of our industrial heritage. And they were saying that they don't see it as a real issue, because I think the average tariff rate they'd have to deal with, say, is 6%. And at that time, the pound had fallen by 15%. Mm. So they were in a pretty sweet spot.
I mean, some companies are more concerned around friction in the custom, like leaving the customs union, than they are around tariffs, right? If you look at retailers, importers like AO World, they've said things that slow down that process are worse for us. Obviously, all tariffs are also very difficult, but you know, prices can, in some instances, be passed on.
Well, prices in most instances are passed on. I mean, that's the whole point about tariffs. I mean, the person that pays the tariffs, eventually we talk about in terms of abstract terms about the UK government, and the UK economy, or the EU administration. But actually, it's the European Union consumer that picks up the tabs for the tariffs. I mean, it's even left-leaning economists like Joseph Stiglitz have pointed this out, and it seems self-evident, really. So what effectively you have with a tariff regime is that it distorts investment decisions, distorts capital flows, very often in favour of inefficient industries. And many of the, as I mentioned before, many of the decisions underlining these tariffs are political-based rather than anything that's based in economics. It also flies in the face of standard economic theory when you look at the division of labour as well. The presumption that some areas within the economy, some national economies, some sectors are actually better and more efficient at producing goods and services than others, and tariffs stand in the way of this mechanism.
Yeah. I mean, it's fair to say that the parties, there is agreement in certain areas like broadband, like transport infrastructure, that there should be large-scale investment. We've had those promises for a long time, right? But would you agree with me that when it comes to Brexit, there are, and the status of UK companies and corporation tax, there is quite a big difference between the parties? I mean, obviously, Labour is saying we will reverse the decreases in corporation tax if we were to get into government. And their vision for the corporate sector is taxing big businesses quite a lot more heavily. Their vision for Brexit is to prioritise jobs, and you'd imagine to compromise in other areas, whereas the Conservatives have been quite clear that what they want to do is further reduce corporation tax and to have certain things such as immigration in the negotiations that they're more set on. So the question being, what some people think is behind the no deal is better than a bad deal, is that they believe that the UK can go its own way as a low tax country destination for corporates. These are two quite different, although for two parties that have a similar vision in terms of the investment they want in the corporate sector, they've got quite different images about the taxation environment they want and what their priorities are with regard to Europe. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, but I mean, this. There's no doubt within this election we've had a clear dichotomy in terms of policy outlooks. I mean, what I mentioned in the feature as well, and it's plainly obvious, it's one of the key economic questions is the degree to which governments intervene in the economy. And obviously, Jeremy Corbyn and the Shadow Chancellor believe in a government that plays a much larger role in the economy. In fact, you know, you could say that they believe in a planned economy to a large extent. This fits in to a certain degree with what happens in Europe now under the current tariff mechanism. But I'm not sure that people in the United Kingdom voted in terms of pure economic policy. I think people voted exactly. Because they can't get jobs, their children can't get housing, there's stagnant economic growth in many parts of the country. We often miss this in London, but there's a huge swathe of the country which for 30, 40, 50 years now have seen a drain of their youth because there's no effective regional development. And I think voters would at least look to Jeremy Corbyn's policies as being sympathetic to that view. Although I'm not quite sure increasing corporation tax would be a key component to creating jobs.
I think dichotomy is the key word, because what this election has left us is no endorsement of any party's policies, Emma, right? There's no party has won a majority. So, like you say, Jeremy Corbyn's brand of Labour, which is more interventionist, which is has more kind of traditional left-wing ideas around the organisation of the economy, has not had a full endorsement, and neither has Theresa May's kind of proposals for how she'll run the Brexit negotiations and how she'd reform the economy.
I think what was disappointing about the Conservative manifesto this time around is a lack of ambition. It seemed to be tinkering at the margins, and people just picked up policy areas and distorted them. I mean, the so-called dementia tax as well seemed to me an absurd debate.
We don't know how much that hurt them. Emma, what were your thoughts?
You're definitely right. It's not a real endorsement of anyone's policies. It's interesting, though, that I think you wrote a taking stock, didn't you, prior to the election about the whole issue of actually there was some overlap also between some of their policies, if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, on the point of intervention, while I completely agree with Mark that the Conservatives went no way as far as the Labour Party in terms of how much they would intervene in the corporate sector or indeed bring it back into the public sector. There are overlaps when it comes to takeovers. The Conservatives wanted to legally enforce pre-deal promises made by companies taking over other companies. Labour wanted to protect workers and pensioners during a takeover situation. When it comes to pay, both parties wanted to strengthen corporate governance rules. There is overlap, but there is also the Labour kind of nationalisms and wanting to bring the Royal Mail back in. There were kind of extras. I mean, one area where there has been overlap that has been much discussed is energy.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's funny, actually, this morning, the share prices of Centrica and SSE are up slightly, I think, by about 2-3%. Obviously, because one of the policies kind of suggested in the Labour manifesto was this idea of re-nationalising the utility companies and you know, the energy companies, which would have created a lot of uncertainty for investors in those companies in terms of how that would have happened.
So that political risk has
been averted, yeah. But then at the same time, I mean, when the Conservatives came out and said that they were considering an energy price cap, that really, really put a dampener on the share prices of particularly a company like Centrica, because they're a customer-facing company now with British Gas. Obviously, it's uncertain now because we've got a hung parliament. But I don't think people should forget that actually that's still a threat to energy companies and things like that.
There's consensus in certain areas.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what's interesting as well, a point that Jeremy Corbyn made in the lead up to the election, he says that his campaign had changed the nature of political discourse in the United Kingdom. And I think we sort of may have taken that with a pinch of salt at the time, but he may well have a point, because when you look at certain of the privatised industries as well, that receive very little in the way of public support and don't seem to have had any major benefits for the consumer. And I'm thinking here of the power companies themselves and the transportation network too. These type of industries affect people on an everyday basis, and they've been wholly unsatisfactory in terms of the free market, because you've effectively got oligopolies working within a constrained pricing network, where even their investment is constrained by preset parameters. So these have been unsatisfactory from the point of view of a sort of red in tooth and claw capitalist, but also from a socialist perspective.
And you don't have to your point there, people are probably not looking at the economic policies across the board as a major voting motivation, but people can reflect on their rail service and they can reflect on the energy prices they are having to pay.
I mean, we were supposed to reflect upon the banks after 2007, 2008, but that was just given lip service, really. Which parts of the economy are parts of the productive economy, and which components are there to serve the productive economy?
I think the cost of living debate, actually, I mean, you know, we can say that the average kind of voter doesn't look across every economic policy, but I think particularly with rail, and I'd argue actually more with energy pricing, that whole cost of living debate is kind of matters to everybody, and particularly people that are really squeezed.
Interestingly, Theresa May early on in her leadership started talking about the just about managings and really trying to target them, and things like the energy price cap they wanted to bring in was to directly address that cost of living debate that you've identified. What the election suggests is that they haven't been as successful doing that as Jeremy Corbyn, who has stressed things like the strength of public services.
Yeah, and if you look at headlines kind of in the later part of the election campaign, it was definitely, you know, there was a division between people didn't align Theresa May. I think most people would agree they didn't align Theresa May with addressing the just about managings. It was definitely kind of the Jeremy Corbyn and some of their policies.
At the same time, Conservatives got the largest number of seats, they got the largest share of the public vote, and in some ways I think we compare it to when they were at a 20 percentage point lead in the polls, but we shouldn't compare it to that. We should say which party has the right to form the government after the election. So Jeremy Corbyn coming out and saying, we all know who won this election. It's quite hard to look at this result and say that the Labour Party won this election.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to look at it relatively, haven't you? Of course, the Labour Party hasn't won this election.
So basically, we're making ourselves complete hostages to fortune because this is very much a moving piece.
Yeah, of course, because it is still a live situation.
Okay, Ace, and I just quickly want to talk about one of the stories that's in the issue, which we haven't really discussed at all, with the exception of Mark's excellent feature, which is Shawbrook, which is an interesting one. We talked about the outlook for domestic banking. Shawbrook is a bank where the majority of its loan book is property finance, mortgages and buy-to-let mortgages, second charge mortgages as well. And also a bit of asset finance to businesses and a little bit of consumer finance. And it's had a takeover offer and a revised takeover offer. And now this is the final offer, isn't it, from its majority shareholder. What are we thinking at the moment about this?
Yeah, so the latest news is basically Pollen Street Capital, which has a 38.8% share in the company, along with BC Partners, so as part of a consortium, have made a fourth and they say final offer now, and they've raised their offer to 340p a share, up from 330p a share, which is interesting in itself, just because the last two offers that they stuck with the 330p, said we're not going to increase it. Now they have.
What value does that put on the assets?
Yeah, so it's valued at around 1.9 times net tangible assets.
Expected.
So that's expected for 2017. that's a premium to Aldermore, which I'd say is its kind of closest peer, which is around 1.2 times forecast net tangible assets, but a discount to One Savings Bank, which I'd say also was, you know, a very similar company, which is at about 2.1 times. So it is a decent premium to its net tangible assets.
And it's an interesting deal because their majority shareholder is saying they want to take the company into private ownership in order to grow it more slowly and more prudently than management are currently planning.
Yeah, they've said Shawbrook, they are growing prudently, but actually, given the growth targets they set out earlier this year, they think they're basically gonna have to revise those, because if they want to maintain writing risk at an appropriate price and lending prudently, actually they are going to have to probably grow at a slower rate.
So, as Shawbrook have said, we can grow within our risk controls, and we can still grow at the rate that we've said. But it's an interesting decision. The Shawbrook investor has to decide whether that premium adequately compensates them for the risk of holding on to that stock. If they think that's undervalued, then are they being quite bullish about the state of that loan book and how it might be impacted from further weakening in the property sector?
Yeah, so there's actually a couple of things to note here. So firstly, yes, obviously they're in buy-to-let lending, and they do have exposure to domestic UK economy, very, very concentrated. And so if there is any weakening there, obviously they could stand to suffer a lot. And after the referendum, they were one of the companies that really suffered in terms of share price. Of course, that has rebounded slightly now. And the second thing to note is that the consortium bidding for the company has actually said, if we get over 50% acceptances, but we don't get 75%, so if we're somewhere in the middle, we would consider keeping it as a listed company. Mm. So I guess that adds another layer of complexity for investors in terms of, if they do get over 50%, keep it as a listed entity.
Not to mention that these kind of takeover targets just got a little bit cheaper, depending on what assets you're using to buy them.
Well, this is true as well. It would have been quite interesting if Jeremy Corbyn did form a government as well, in terms of the utilities that he intends on privatising. You know, just by his intent alone, it would make him cheaper for the public purse.
Yeah, it's been almost a little bit boring from our perspective. We could have had some crazy share price moves if Labour got closest to number 10.
Well, that's it. I mean, it'd be interesting. A week from now, we might have a very different perspective as well. Who can say?
But stories like Shawbrook will continue regardless of who gets through the door of number 10 or stays within the door of number 10. Well, that's all we have time for on this special edition of the Companies and Markets show. Thanks, Mark, for joining me. Thanks, Emma. Thanks, Dom, in the control room. A lot of people with some bags under their eyes and fueling themselves on coffee. But it's been an absolutely fascinating night, and we'll obviously keep in touch with the impact on listed companies. But I think it's fair to say, not quite as apocalyptic a situation as the referendum. And there's plenty more in the magazine, which I haven't even got to, which is terrible of me, but it's £4.90.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In all decent news agents, go out and have a look.